And good morning. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, sitting in for Leslie Thatcher today. Taking a look ahead at this hour, we'll kick it off with meteorologist Nate Larson to give us a weather update. The Utah Avalanche Forecast Center will call in with their update. Then Executive Director of the Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District, Mike Lors, has a really interesting update. Park City Board of Education members Andrew Kaplan and Wendy Crossland will discuss Tuesday night's school board meeting. And then Habitat for Humanity Programs Manager Megan Nielsen will be in. This all coming up this hour. Stay with us. We'll kick it off here with ABC Forecast Center meteorologist Nate Larson. Good morning to you, Nate.
All right. Hey, good morning, Park City. Yeah, turning out to be a pretty nice start to your Wednesday. Still have some clouds hanging around this morning. Fortunately, the storm system from yesterday and overnight didn't really put down much new snow, just a little bit here and there. In fact, I just show 0.8 inches of precipitation at the base of Park City. So lighter precipitation amounts. In fact, heading into this afternoon, should see mostly sunny skies. Highs just near 34, though, so we are colder today. Looking at some breezy winds at times as well. Overnight lows back to 19 into Thursday morning. We do have more moisture moving through the mountain areas in northern Utah tonight into Thursday, so we could see a little bit of light snow shower activity overnight into tomorrow. Highs near 34 again on Thursday with snow showers possible off and on throughout the day. 19 on Thursday night into Friday with a high of 40. So we are going to warm up into the weekend, but it's going to take a minute. So a high of just 40 on Friday. Slight chance of snow showers remaining, so plan on partly to mostly cloudy skies. And then into the weekend, fairly quiet conditions are expected to settle back in. Temperatures rebounding to 45 on Saturday, 52 on Sunday. Should see a mix of sun and clouds throughout the weekend. We are tracking a little more moisture that's going to graze northern Utah into early next week. So we'll throw in another slight chance of some rain Sunday night into Monday. Temperatures falling to 50 on Monday. Overnight lows in the mid-50s and a slight chance of rain and snow showers on Tuesday with a high of 47. Back to you guys.
Okay. Thanks, Nate.
You bet.
So glad that we get this update from the executive director of the Snyderville Basin Reclamation, Mike Lors. Good morning to you, Mike. It's great to have you.
Oh, awesome to be here.
There is some big news, and let's start with what you call clean water connections. Now, this is something I had no idea of, but as we all have been talking about getting our sump pumps working and ready to go for that expected flooding, there are some really important things we need to know.
Yes, well, sure. Thank you for asking about our clean water program. So clean water connections are those connections that include sump pumps and other connections that pick up groundwater and snowmelt and pump it into the wastewater system. These types of connections are illegal, but the real problem is that they overload the system and can cause raw sewage to back up not only in your home, but your neighbor's home and surrounding businesses. So we're asking people to give us a call if they think they have a sump pump. We'll come out free of charge and inspect to see if they do, in fact, have a sump pump, if it's connected to the stormwater system, which is where it's supposed to be connected, or the wastewater or sewer system. And if it's connected to the sewer system, we have a limited time offer where we can give them $1,500 as a financial incentive to help disconnect. But, you know, what this really gets down to, Lynn, is, you know, when you have a gallon jug and it's filled with water, you can't add any more water to it. Our sewer lines are the same way. They are picking up the wastewater that we all generate every day. But now if you have a sump pump pumping tens of thousands of gallons a day into it, that pipe simply cannot hold any more water, and it's going to overflow someplace. And wherever it overflows, it's going to be raw sewage, and we want to avoid that at all costs.
And there's quite a nasty photo you have on your website of what can happen to someone's toilet, for example, when the sewage blocks up. So don't be that person in your that does it to your neighbors. But it's interesting. I think that most people don't know that these types of connections are illegal or there's no code for allowing them.
That's correct.
But a lot of people do have sump pumps. The one that I bought for the possibility this year of flooding is a portable one, and it says hook up to your garden hose, basically, and then it would just be running out into your yard if you're draining from, say, your crawl space or basement. And so that's the that is okay, because it's obviously not going, it's not a direct connection to the sewer.
That's correct. You know, if you pump it in the backyard or pump it out to the curb where there's a catch basin where it enters the stormwater system, that's the way you're supposed to do it. But we've I've had a few people call us and say, hey, my plumber is installing a sump pump, and he said that by code it has to be connected to the wastewater system. Well, in fact, that is not correct. International Plumbing Code and our codes prohibit connecting sump pumps to the wastewater system. And if you do connect them and bad things happen, you can be held liable for that, and that can be very, very expensive. So if you have a sump pump, even if it was installed recently, give us a call. We've already conducted many inspections, and we're happy to do so to help people out. But you really want to avoid flooding your neighbor's home. And not only that, but this extra water that's in the system goes to the treatment plant, and we have to treat it. Well, clean water doesn't need to be treated. And it's actually very difficult to deal with it when you mix it in with and you dilute normal wastewater at the treatment plant. So it not only can back up in someone's home, but it can cause an environmental impact because our treatment facilities don't operate properly.
Okay. So again, a $1,500 financial incentive to homeowners to disconnect these clean water connections. Well, first of all, how do you know how your sump pump is connected or not? I suppose it's whether or not there's a garden hose.
Well, you know, there are many, many sump pumps that people have had installed in their crawl spaces, in their basement, and they're plumbed permanently into something. And most folks, unless they actually have an idea of which pipe is what in their home, they have no clue. And that's where we can come in and help, and give us a call. We can come in and we can trace the pipe that's coming out of the sump pump and let you know where it's connected.
Oh, this is great to know. Yeah. Also, roof drains. So this is, you know, a lot of our water is coming off of a roof drain. Most of us assume it just goes on the downspout and flows out into the yard. But is it, I would have no idea that many of them are actually plumbed to go into the stormwater.
So in some locations, think of a home that's kind of in a depressed area. You know, you have one of these driveways that kind of goes down the hill and the house sitting down low. In those cases, unfortunately, sometimes people will take downspouts because they have no place to put the water for it to flow normally, like a storm drain, and they tie those drains into the sanitary sewer system. And we have these remote cameras that we use to inspect inside of these pipes. And we can tell very readily and very easily if a downspout or a sump pump is connected, because you have nothing but clean water coming into the system, you know, tens of thousands of gallons in a day's time. And so we are aware that this happens. The downspout situation isn't quite as common as the sump pumps, but they certainly exist here in the Park City area.
Yeah, very interesting. Again, a $1,500 financial incentive to homeowners who may or may not have, but give a call to the Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District and have them come out and take a look. So I said stormwater when I meant to say to the sewer system, but stormwater is on my mind a lot. You mentioned about, you know, diluting, if you dilute what comes in through the sewer system at the treatment center, that messes up the treatment center. Now with all of the runoff and talking about all of this runoff going into the stormwater drains, how does that affect your operation in terms of water treatment?
Well, let's kind of take a step back, Lynn. The stormwater system is a set of pipes that collects rainwater, snow melt, and such. That is a separate system from the sanitary or the sewer system, which is a closed system that collects everything that you flush, you shower, your laundry. So two separate systems. So the water that's being collected by the stormwater system, meaning rainwater, snowmelt, flows into the nearest creek or stream and eventually makes its way down to the Weber River. Great snowpack is great for the environment because it helps keep our natural environment healthy. As you will know, during some dry summer months, the amount of water in our local streams has been very, very low, and that's been a problem for our native trout species, mainly the Bonneville cutthroat trout. So these great snow years are kind of like a big sponge. You know, the mountain holds the water, and it slowly releases it into the streams and provides great flows for the fish and other aquatic organisms all year long.
Oh, that's interesting. So none of that water is mixed into the sewer treatment facility. In my mind, some amount of help from outside water would be, you know, would be part of the system, but I guess not.
Yeah. No, any of the water that flows down the streams, that never enters our system. Think of this. Our wastewater treatment system is a living system where we have all these little microscopic bugs that eat the organic material that we all flush. Mm-hmm. If there's not any organic material there, meaning clean water, those little microscopic organisms starve to death, and then we have no treatment.
Yeah, okay. Well, on April 12th, so about a week ago, the East Canyon Water Reclamation Facility had a peak flow of 12 million gallons a day. So over 65% of that was from snowmelt getting into the system. Of course, now we're looking at flooding. We're, you know, too much of a good thing, but good to see the East Canyon water flowing. But where is it at capacity, and where are they with sandbags?
So when we talk about 12 million gallons, that's 12 million gallons in the sanitary sewer system, what people flush and not. The reason it's 12 million gallons is because we have a lot of sump pumps pumping extra water into the system, and that snow melt is coming from the sump pumps. It's not coming from snow melt running down the road.
Okay.
Yeah. So 8 out of that 12 million was extra water that was added to our system.
Okay.
That's very, very significant.
So the 65% is not a good thing. It's what we want to avoid.
Correct.
By not emptying into the system.
So that treatment plan is designed to handle 5 million gallons a day.
Wow.
Yeah, and we're running 12 through it.
And so in terms of treatment, does it just foil your efforts? Does it take more energy to treat the water?
You know, if a little bit of extra water is in a system, say it seeps in through manhole covers or something, we can handle that. But when 65% of it is being pumped in from downspouts and sump pumps, that becomes a real problem. And our operating staff are working overtime to correctly operate the system. It becomes very problematic, and you know, it's something that we really want to avoid.
Okay, so East Canyon Creek now, in terms of flooding, where are we on that?
Good question.
You're close to that.
You know, yesterday morning we had a peak flow in the Jeremy Ranch area on East Canyon Creek of about 380 cubic feet per second. We'll put that in perspective. The creek was out of its banks, but yet not seriously flooding any structures, but certainly very high water. There is an ice dam upstream that it's north of the Kimmel Junction area that was built many, many years ago, and that's starting to fail. It's holding some water, so there's some issues up there for the Swanner Nature Preserve. And if that dam were to break loose at one time, it would send a large amount of water downstream as a result of the breaching of that dam. So we're all keeping an eye on that. But overall, the water's high, and certainly there's been some flooding on some of the tributaries like Willow Creek and places like that. But so far, so good.
Yeah. I drove by the Weber River the other day, and it is not out of its banks, but it's pretty darn close.
Right.
And that, as we know, can be controlled, but only to a certain degree, right?
And, you know, we've been very fortunate the last couple of weeks. We've had some, you know, 3 or 4 warm days, and the flows would really jump up, and we'd all get concerned. And then it would cool off. You know, last night it was below freezing. Tonight it's going to be below freezing. And that lets the stream kind of, you know, settle back down a little bit. So we've been really fortunate, but as you well know, we have lots of snow still in the mountain, and if we get 3, 4, 5, or 2 or 3 weeks of 60-degree weather, more likely to have some flooding.
Absolutely. Well, let's move on to your weekly wastewater surveillance. So one of the things that Snyderville Basin Water Rec does is charts the SARS-CoV-2 concentrations in the water. And first of all, let me ask you this. How have you been able to ascertain the prediction of COVID in the community? What is the margin of error when you measure at your source?
Okay, so we collect samples twice a week from both of our facilities. We work with the health department, and we've been doing this since April of 2020, where we collect samples and we look for the genetic material associated with the SARS-CoV-2 virus. There's not a, we can't say that, hey, if we have 10 counts of viral genetic material, that you're gonna have 2 cases of infection someplace in the community. It's not that direction. It's not that tightly correlated. Mm-hmm. But what we can say is, as we see greater amounts of genetic material in the wastewater, that's because there's greater number of cases in the community.
Mm-hmm.
So it is correlated, but not to like a one-on-one correlation. So good news is the counts are coming down. It's still a little high at the East Canyon facility and the Silver Creek facility, have been both high, but they're coming down. So that's good news. And we call this wastewater-based epidemiology, and we anticipate that this will continue and possibly even spread to other diseases in the future, such as, influenza, things like that.
It's a really interesting aspect of the work you do out there. And I would think that as fewer and fewer people are actually reporting when they do have COVID, most of us take a home COVID test and, oh, we have it, so we stay home for 5 days and hope to get better. Many of us are not reporting it. And so it would seem that the work that you're doing is one of the main indicators as we go forward.
Yeah, certainly the health department is using the information that's coming from the wastewater utilities to a greater degree now than they did previously, for the exact reason you just mentioned, that cases generally are not being reported.
Okay. So just quickly on that, though, it's interesting that there are parts of Summit County where they're still in the elevated category. If you look at sort of the rest of Utah, for example, most places are, have continued to decrease. Can you give us an overall view of how we're doing?
Yeah, it's not unusual for us to see some elevated levels when other places are lower, and we attribute that to being a resort community. The Silver Creek side, which is the eastern side of the town, is elevated a little bit right now, as is, Wasatch County. But Heber's low, but would be the kind of the resort portion of the mountain over there. So this is something we've seen time and time again. It'll come up, go back down, and we attribute it to, being a resort community.
Mm-hmm. Still those tourists bringing it or I don't know what it is, mixing it up. Okay, anything else you wanted to mention this morning?
Just real quick, our flush index, we like to estimate the number of people in town based on the amount of wastewater coming down the system. And for the month of March, we estimated that there were 383,313 visitors, which is interesting about this. That's almost a 19% increase over March of 2022. And obviously, that's probably because of the snow.
Absolutely. Yeah. Keeps on keeping on, doesn't it?
Keep on keeping on, yeah.
All right. Mike Lures is the executive director of the Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Hey, thank you for having me, Lynn.
And stay with us. News Time Now, 8:25. We'll be back after these words. KPCW News Time Now, 8:26. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak, sitting in for Leslie Thatcher this morning. 2 people were killed when a car crossed the double line on Highway 189 near Wallsburg on Tuesday afternoon and crashed into an SUV going the opposite direction. It happened around 2:30 p.m. yesterday. According to the Utah Highway Patrol, a 2022 Lucid Air, which is an electric vehicle, was headed southbound. Witnesses say it was traveling at high speed around milepost 21 when it crossed into the northbound lanes and hit the left front end of a 2004 GMC Yukon. Both vehicles ended up on the northbound shoulder. The Lucid caught fire and became fully engulfed in flames. The drivers of both cars died. Two other cars were involved, a Jeep Patriot and a Subaru Crosstrek. The drivers in those vehicles suffered minor injuries. The road between the Heber Valley and Provo was closed for more than 5 hours while investigators examined the scene and crews cleared the road. Officers directed traffic in alternating directions on the southbound shoulder during that time. The identities of the drivers who died in the incident have not yet been released. Tuesday morning, attorneys argued about whether Dakota Pacific can build in Kimball Junction while being sued by Summit County. KPCW's Connor Thomas has the ruling.
Judge Richard Mrazek denied Summit County a preliminary injunction that would pause a potential mixed-use development in Kimball Junction. But if Dakota Pacific does try to build, Mrazek signaled he may change his mind. The injunction hearing was the first major battle in the county's case against Dakota Pacific Real Estate and the state of Utah over a state bill, Senate Bill 84. Counties say SB 84 violates local land use authority, illegally and unconstitutionally, because it could allow the developer the right to build a mixed-use community on land zoned for tech offices. The hearing was not long, just a little more than 30 minutes. Attorney Mitch Stevens represented the county Tuesday, and Richard Burbage spoke for Dakota Pacific. The issue was narrow, too. Without an injunction, would there be irreparable harm to Summit County? Mrazek thought no. He said the county can still exercise control over other aspects of construction at the Kimball Junction Tech Park, like building permits.
The court is simply not persuaded that there is any likelihood that the status quo is going to change until the court makes final decisions.
That's in spite of Stevens' argument that the court can't be certain of that unless it grants the injunction.
It's anticipatory, it's threatened. Right. The basis for a preliminary injunction and the goal of a preliminary injunction is to preserve the status quo.
The judge didn't think an injunction was necessary because construction is conspicuous and slow. He signaled that if it did in fact begin, he would stop it.
If circumstances change, the court may make a different decision.
In advance of that hearing, Dakota Pacific CEO Mark Stanworth filed an affidavit declaring the developer has no plans to build right now. That was the company's lawyer's main argument Tuesday.
We would be foolish in the extreme to go out and start building without a building permit. That's not going to happen. I mean, they're casting Dakota Pacific as some rogue developer.
But Summit County argued words are just words. There needs to be a way to enforce them. Mrazek seemed to agree, but any enforcement is on ice until and only if Dakota Pacific attempts to build. Both parties told KPCW they were pleased with the result. Summit County Council Chair Roger Armstrong said in a statement, quote, "While the county council believes the requested injunction is warranted, we are pleased Judge Mrazek left open the option for Summit County to again seek an injunction if DPRE attempts development outside of Summit County approval processes." Dakota Pacific attorney Carolyn LaDuke said there is no immediate threat of construction.
We think that was the right result. As we pointed out at the hearing, Dakota Pacific doesn't have any shovels in the ground, doesn't have any bulldozers on the property.
Mrazek used the rest of the hearing to decide the order of future proceedings. Monday evening, the state of Utah and Dakota Pacific both filed motions to dismiss the county's various claims against them. A full list of their responses to the county's 8 claims are in the online version of this report. But Summit County filed in March for partial summary judgments on 2 of its claims. That means the county thinks it's entitled to early judgments because aspects of its case are obviously correct or haven't been contested by countervailing evidence. So the court needs to decide which to consider first, the motions to dismiss the claims or the motion for early judgments on some of those same claims. Mrazek decided to put all pending deadlines for briefs on hold. That includes the brief Summit County would ordinarily have 14 days to file in response to Utah and Dakota Pacific's motions to dismiss. In the meantime, the court will decide which motions to consider next. For more on the case, visit kpcw.org. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
I'm joined now in the studio by 2 members of the Park City School Board, Andrew Kaplan and Wendy Crossland. They're giving us an update on yesterday's board meeting. Good morning to both of you.
Morning, Lynn.
Morning.
Well, Andrew, let's kick it off with you. The big issue in yesterday's meeting was this big project that you're doing for getting community outreach first and introducing a, I don't know if it's a policy, but it's educational equity. Would you call it a new policy or guidelines?
Yeah, so it's policy 1006, educational equity. And what's interesting about it is that, you know, equity has always been a core pillar of what the school district focuses on. We, you know, every policy or decision the board or the administration makes has an equity lens. When we did master planning, when we looked at, we got community input about, I think it was 2017, and we set up five kind of pillars. Academic excellence, was the first, but equity was one of them. And it's always been something that the district has led in terms of looking at and recognizing that every child has a different brain, every child learns differently, every child needs different resources in order to achieve their academic potential. And so, some of those things have to do with socioeconomic background, some of them have to do with learning disabilities. There's a whole host of things that are involved in education when it comes to achieving your potential. And we've always, as a district, looked at that. We've always focused on narrowing achievement gaps. We're an interesting district in that we have a very high-performing cohort of kids who are going to top schools and going to four-year colleges. We also have kids who no one in their family has ever gone to university. And so it's about getting everyone an opportunity. And that starts from birth. And, we're very fortunate that we're in a community that prioritizes early childhood education. The work that the Community Foundation has done to bring attention to that and just to the differences that, some kids are read to every night as a baby, and some kids aren't read to at all until they get into kindergarten. And when you have that disparity, you end up in a situation where kids are starting at very different levels, and that means that the entire class cohort, ends up moving at a slower pace. So, what's happened is that the community has asked us to look at equity. They've asked us to create a policy around it and really codify what we've been doing for, 10 plus years in the district and really longer. The work the Ed Foundation has done, et cetera, has been equity focused for a long time. The problem we're having is that, had we done this probably 5 years ago, no one would have blinked an eye. However, the national political climate has turned equity into a dirty word, and it makes people very nervous on both sides of the aisle. So, we had a lot of public comment yesterday, which was great. We're going to have a couple forums, which Wendy will talk about, opening it up to all community members to give their views on this. It's not necessarily changing the direction of the district, or the curriculum of hiring practices. This is not affirmative action or CRT or DEI. It's really just codifying what we've been doing for a long time and making it known to everyone.
So Wendy, if you said to the average person in the community, taxpayer, parent, whoever it is, we want to make sure that every child gets the opportunity to be educated in a way that meets their individual mm-hmm. difference. Mm-hmm. There's no one that would disagree with that. What is, right. what, you know, as Andrew said, obviously this word equity has become very mm-hmm. politicized. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons that you're calling it educational equity mm-hmm. is to hopefully move away from that word. What kept you from calling it something else, and what keeps you focusing on the positive part of the message and getting away from the the politics?
Yeah, great question. We've also used the term safe, inclusive. I think backing away for a second, it's really important to understand education has always, for a century, we've had the opportunity to reflect and implement new policies that guide practices and procedures to have more inclusive education. you know, in the 70s and 80s, my brother-in-law couldn't have been in school. He reads and writes at a third grade level, and he was not included in many classrooms. Because of our reflection and understanding barriers that have been in the way for certain, for different students at different times, we've been able to progress towards a more inclusive environment and educational opportunity. I think this policy, it codifies what's already happening, and it recognizes that maybe some of the obvious barriers to opportunities that we've addressed, like academic fees, there are other barriers that we haven't always seen or heard about. And this is, I think, progress towards hearing some of those barriers that maybe aren't so obvious and not obvious to all students and to all of us in this community. I think that we also need to remember that policies and practices don't address every student and all of their needs. My kids don't need the interventionist. My kids don't need some of the practices and educational opportunities that are that we actively implement in schools right now. They all needs have to have different ways of being met. And I think this policy is trying to reflect a moment where we have recognized that for many of our students and many in marginalized groups, there are barriers still that exist that we're trying to understand better and address better. So I would say that this, and we've intentionally done this. I'm on this committee, and I'm really proud that we've been patient and we've been intentional about implementing and drafting a policy that reflects the true needs and voices of those who are really, now recognizing where there are barriers. It also codifies all the good stuff we're doing. As Andrew said, we've been doing this for a long time. We've had this in our mission statement. The word itself, I think, could be getting in the way. And I think recognizing it's not a zero-sum game. We're not trying to take anything away from anybody and give it to somebody else. We're just trying to address where we are, and progress can be complicated and messy, and I think we're doing our best to learn from where mistakes have been made in this work. I appreciate everybody who showed up last night. It means they care. They brought up good ideas and thoughts of things we need to consider. That's why we're going to have the forums, because I think we can learn from mistakes made. And I'm grateful that we're taking this on.
So any project which involves community outreach is a big one. You have to look at all of the different segments of the community and figure out how you're going to reach them. We know that in your world of families that belong to the Park City School District, those are your sort of closest target and easiest target to at least get the information out to. How are you getting the information out to someone like me? For example, my kids have graduated from the school district. And I, you know, once your kids are no longer in the district, say you're just a taxpayer and you don't have kids, how do we get involved? How do you reach out to us?
Yeah, so, our communications team, which is called the FACE group, they are going to post on I think, our social media, the both the dates and times of the meetings. Mm-hmm. I think the first one is April 25th. During the day at the district office, it's at 10 o'clock. And then the following week, there's going to be two meetings at Ecker. The first one is 5:30 on May 2nd. The second one is at 6:30. The first one's in English. The second one is in Spanish. There'll also be an opportunity to email in comments and thoughts for the record. We've gotten through this process, I think, something over 200 comments already and pieces of input. Both for and against, or pros and cons of the policy, or suggestions for editing. And the response has been pretty good so far. I think, most people have, one of two views. I think everyone kind of agrees that they want the best for children, that they want the best for education and the best results. I think there's understandable fear due to the what's happened, especially in higher education, about what these terms mean and will we be employing affirmative action in our hiring practices? Will we be hiring DEI deans and things like that, which, you know, that's not what's being discussed here. It's more about, okay, what does the community want? And this has been a conversation that the district has been having with the community for years. And so it's not a new one. It's really, we're not starting over. We're not starting from scratch. And that's the good thing is that we're not, we don't need to say to everyone, all right, look, we're, you know, this is a new project for us. This is really refining work, years of work. And, you know, people are definitely stepping up and giving their opinions. And I think we're going to get to a place where hopefully the majority of people in the community are comfortable that this is an accurate reflection of community values and interests.
So you've used a couple of acronyms, Andrew, CRT, critical race theory. You say it's not that. DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. You say it's not that, and yet we have this very diverse school district. You want to be equitable. There's that word. And you want to be inclusive. There's that word. And so, again, it's the lexicon, right? Who would say they don't want DEI? And you're saying, well, we're not going to have DEI deans, but it's triggering for some people. What, well, is it a concern to you that you're only going to hear from the outliers? Were, you know, the people on the extremes, is that who showed up at the meeting last night to give public comment, Wendy?
I don't know. All of the of those who showed up last night, there were definitely both sides. I think that, language is triggering. I would encourage people to read the policy and understand the context here. This is about educational equity for students. That the words diversity, equity, and inclusion are triggering and are discussion in society right now that is polarizing, that we're better than that. I think that we're beyond that. That's not what this is about. And I think that to say it's not DEI, and correct me if I'm wrong, but Andrew means we're not doing this because it's a trend and it's a political statement we're trying to make. We didn't come into this in 2023 and say, oh, look at all of these organizations are adopting DEI systems and practices. This has been an evolution. It's landing in 2023 as a moment where we're actually putting it on the agenda. We've done this patiently. We've done this intentionally. And I would hope that, and I believe that our community can look beyond the triggering language and see the substance of this and recognize that our job as elected board members, we legally have a duty to create, adopt, amend policies and work with the budget to help guide and support our educators to give educational opportunities to all of our students. We have staff that's asking for PD so they can understand how to give those opportunities to all students. We need this policy gives us the more specificity and guidance and foundations to support our educators to do this. And I think we can look beyond the language and get this moving forward.
I like what you say. We're better than this. Mm-hmm. We are better than the language that may surround triggering issues. So again, you've got these forums coming up. Can you give us the dates again?
Yes. The first one is April 25th from 10 to 11 in the district office. And the second set is May 2nd, 5:30 to 6:30 in English at Ecker Library and 6:30 to 7:30 in Spanish at the Ecker Library.
Okay, great. Yeah. And then also, I mean, I have seen emails. I'm on someone's email list, so yeah. I have seen an opportunity for feedback. I don't know if that goes out to the whole community, sort of the outline of the policy or the outline of what you're talking about and soliciting feedback. So you can just do that via email as well.
Yeah, that's correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Let's move on quickly. There was a revision to the school calendar, something about snow days and a makeup schedule. I'm understanding that the Monday following the normal end of school, mm-hmm. there will be a half day. Mm-hmm. Is that correct, or a full day? How does this all fit in, and what are the state laws and requirements?
Yeah, so there's a, I don't know the exact educational hours required, but there are, you know, state mandated school days and educational hours required. What we learned this year, and we haven't had to, you know, at least since I've been on the board, build in snow days. I think we've had, prior to this year, we've had one in the last 10 years, maybe two. Mm-hmm. This year we had one plus a power outage day on Kern's mm-hmm. campus. So, or Jeremy, there was an issue. But, you know, what we learned was, is that, you know, if we build in extra snow days to the calendar, we are able to apply for a waiver should we need them from the state. If we don't have extra snow days built in, we can't get a waiver, mm-hmm. Which is the case this year. So we are going to have an extra day on that Monday. It'll be hopefully a fun day where, you know, some of the traditions of the last day of school will occur, like the walkouts at the mm-hmm. elementaries, things like that will occur on that day. That'll be the Monday following graduation. Next year, we've built in any future year, we've built in the possibility of five extra snow days. We always have one extra day that we can use, which is a professional development day in March. So that will be kind of our first snow day. And then if we go over that, we have the ability to extend that into the first week of June following graduation. But now that we have this in our schedule, we're also eligible to apply for a waiver to waive that last day of school. So, you know, hopefully we have some other great winters ahead of us like this one where we have tons of snow. But, you know, I think it's more of a one-off, and we've learned our lesson that, you know, we need to have these days built in so that we can, you know, apply for waivers. You know, there's certainly some families that this impacts because they had plans to leave town right after school. And, you know, look, it's always a family's choice whether to send their kids to school on that last day or not.
I just have to say, since you are building in the snow days, you know what that means? We'll never have another snow year like
I know. It's like buying a new pair of powder skis, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Hey, I've got to let you go, but just quickly, I wanted to ask you how remote learning is changing. Is that becoming more restrictive? I know a lot of parents are still taking their kids out of school and they're, you know, learning remotely while they go on a month-long trip to Costa Rica.
I mean, I think we really encourage and believe strongly in in-person learning. I mean, there's no all it's the best way, and it's also, I think, again, it's a family's choice to go remote and have the opportunity. We're always going to lean towards doing what's best for the district and our students, which is in-person learning. And to the extent we can continue to do that, we will always lean into that in our district. I think families have choices, as they always have. And this is a place where there's a lot of opportunity for kids to learn in different environments. I know it's appreciative in high school. There's a lot of kids that I, you know, take classes online because they're taking either a different class through a different university or program, and it's allowing them to have more flexible schedules.
Okay. Great. Yeah. Wendy Crossland, Andrew Kaplan from the Park City School Board, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks, Lynn.
Thanks for having us.
This is the KPCW Local News Hour. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, filling in for Leslie Thatcher today. Joining me now on the phone is Megan Nielsen. She's the Administrative Services Manager of Habitat for Humanity of Summit and Wasatch Counties. Good morning to you, Megan.
Hi, Lynn. Good morning to you.
Well, you are joining this morning to talk about something interesting and a bit unique for Habitat for Humanity. It's a financial education class for women. It's called She Means Business. I love that title. Tell us all about it.
Right. So this is actually, we've been doing this course for about 5 years now. This will be our seventh series, and it is a 5-week long course. Women from the community, it's open to the public. They join us over the course of 5 weeks, one day a week, typically in the evenings. This 5-week course will be held April 26th May 3rd, May 10th, May 17th, and May 24th, so over those Wednesday evenings. And it's going to be online this time around. And really what we are working on through this course is kind of the basics of all things financial that we don't really get anywhere else in the world. We don't get it in our education when we're brought up. Often it's just, you know, these are basics that we're not exposed to. So we really look at what is your relationship with money, what is your story around money, and we look at the basics of budgeting, savings, spending plans, anything around the financial goals that these women might have and how to achieve them. We look at the ins and outs of credit, what it means, how you can improve it, how you can remove negative or incorrect things from your credit report. We look at how to manage your debt. And we also look at home ownership. You know, we are Habitat for Humanity, so we look at what the mortgage process is. And our executive director, Shelley Barris, joins us for a class to talk about affordable local housing. And we also look at the basics of investing and just more around visioning and goal setting for the future before we send these women off.
Yes. So it's taught by some dynamic local women in the financial industry. Yes. Kathleen Barlow, who's quite well known. Lindsay Powers from America First Credit Union. Nanette Bush from Fairway Mortgage Corp. And then, as you said, Shelley Barris from Habitat for Humanity. And again, this 5-week course is on Wednesday nights. It starts April 26th. From 6 to 7:30 p.m., it's online, it's free. Wow, that seems pretty easy. And last year, you served 120 women. So there is obviously a need and a desire for this information. You know, I just was talking to a friend of mine yesterday, and she said she has never prepared their taxes. She's never gone through the whole tax thing. And her husband always does it. And I thought, well, that is very interesting in our modern world where still there are, you know, there's either one or the other in a partnership or a marriage, or even if you're single, there are these things that maybe you have not done. I'm curious about in your past, you know, what's the age, what's the demographic here? What's the age span of people coming to this course?
Yeah, Lynn, we have the last class I'm just thinking of, we had women in their early 20s. We had retired women who came and also said similar things that, you know, they're just some things that they've never done before, whether it be taxes or just simply doing a monthly budget. They have never opened a new bank account. Maybe it's because they're younger. Maybe it's because, you know, their partner has been doing that. And we get a lot of women who may be single or recently single, recently divorced, and they have a lot of these basic things that, you know, we should all know and need to know, but have never been exposed to it or had the experience. So it really runs the gamut as far as who is coming to these classes. I'm continuously surprised by who shows up. And, you know, we get a lot of great feedback about how none of these concepts are rocket science, but they are so important and really life-changing when you can walk away with the tools to make sure that you're financially set. And what we really try to instill as well is, you know, kind of a mindset shift around money. I think that gets in a lot of people's way. We have a lot of negative thoughts about money. There's a lot of shame around money sometimes, especially if you struggled or, again, if you don't have the knowledge.
Are you still there, Megan? Do I have you? Megan, do I have you back there?
Yes.
Okay. Sorry, you went out for a while. Let me just, in the next minute that we have remaining, some other news. The Park City Restore, which is also a Habitat for Humanity program, it's undergoing a remodel, celebrating a grand reopening in the next few months. It'll be the 10th anniversary also of the Restore. When will this be happening?
So we have already hit our 10th anniversary early this month of the restore, which is very exciting. And yeah, if you've been in there recently, you will see that we've been under construction and moving things around. And we will be done with that, in the next couple of months. So we have kind of been going back and forth on our grand reopening date just because, things always take a little bit longer than you expect. So we will be announcing that shortly. But very, very exciting. Come on in if you haven't been in there.
Okay, great. And the overall ball is taking place June 23rd. This is your annual fundraiser. Early bird tickets are on sale now through the website, which is habitat-utah.org. And tell us a little bit about the overall ball.
Right. So, June 23rd is our annual fundraising gala, and it will be at Legacy Lodge. We made a switch last year from the fall to the summer, so it's been kind of nice. And one thing that is different this year as well is we are doing some early bird pricing. So tickets are on sale right now. They go to our regular price as of May 1st. So visit our website, grab a ticket. It's a fun event. The only event that I at least know of in the community where you can wear overalls and dress down, put on your construction hat, and we have a great silent auction and great program, and it's just a really fun event. We call it the best dress down event of the year.
I love that. All right. Megan Nielsen is the Administrative Services Manager for Habitat for Humanity. Megan, thanks so much for joining me today. And again, that course begins April 26th. That's next Wednesday. And how do you register?
Yes, thank you, Lynn. So you can go to our website at habitat-utah.org. or send an email to programs@habitat-utah.org.
Okay. Thanks, Megan.
Thank you, Lynn.